to the Naval Academy Museum Warrior Riders Podcast. I'm your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander. In this 14-part series, we'll take you decade by decade, starting with the 1870s, discussing the significant naval events and developments that helped shape the U.S. Navy to coincide with the Naval Academy Museum exhibit, Warrior Riders, the U.S. Naval Institute, open from September 10, 2015 through January 31, 2016. Our guest for each episode leading us through the decades will be Naval Academy History Professor Emeritus and noted Naval Historian Dr. Craig Simmons and Naval Academy Museum Director Claude Barabe. Craig, as we work our way into the 1880s, in this decade, memories of the Civil War were beginning to fade. Did the nation now begin to look outward as well as inward to assess its future?
Well, you would think so. America's attention span isn't all that long. You would think there would be some new interest. But by and large, I think the answer to that is probably not. The West was still filling up. There was a lot going on internally that kept Americans focused on problems here at home. There were, labor issues that were beginning to develop as labor unions began to contest against the really unfair and exploitive labor practices of the late 19th century. Perhaps one of the most famous examples of that is the Haymarket riot in Chicago in 1886, where an anarchist threw a bomb in the middle of a labor protest, and the policemen opened fire on the crowd, and it got entirely out of hand. So internal problems like that, issues like internal improvements, the Brooklyn Bridge, for example, was opened in the 1880s. So there's a lot going on internally to the United States that really kept Americans' attention focused inward and not so much outward. And that, of course, was reflected in the way Congress appropriated or didn't appropriate funds for the Navy as well. So it's not quite the beginning of what will become a naval revolution in the next decade, though there are a few straws in the wind.
How about the physical condition of the Navy in the 1880s with all this focus in other areas? And did Congress during this time period really begin to look at new construction?
Well, they started to. Yes, that's true. And the condition of the Navy, by now, the vessels that were left over at the end of the Civil War had reached, critical mass, whatever phrase you want to use. They're really beginning to fall apart. It's all but embarrassing, and in some cases, quite literally embarrassing. I'm reminded of a short story that was written by Oscar Wilde in the middle of the 1880s that my friend John Hattendorf at the Naval War College likes to cite, because Oscar Wilde wrote a story called The Canterville Ghost. And in this story, the ghost is talking to an American. And the American says, well, in America, we don't have what you British have. We don't have any curiosities or ruins. And the ghost says, what? No curiosities and no ruins? Why, you have your manners and your navy. Well, that's, that kind of disrespect is hard to take from anyone, but particularly, I suppose, from the British Empire. But it's a reflection of how Europeans looked at the now not quite collapsing, but certainly deteriorating American Navy that had come into the 1880s. And in recognition of that, Congress did begin to think, well, maybe some of these old, worn-out ships need to be replaced. Historians often look at 1883. Because that's the year Congress first authorized new construction warships, three cruisers, what were called protected cruisers, that is armored cruisers, and a dispatch vessel. It began the tradition of naming cruisers after cities. The three cruisers were the Albany, the Baltimore, and the Chicago. And the dispatch vessel was the Dolphin, so they're often written down as the A, B, C, D ships, and testimonial to their names. And they were modern, the first modern ships really built since the Civil War. They looked old-fashioned. They still had soaring masts and square-rigged spars, and they could go from place to place under sail, but they had electricity rather than lanterns below deck. They had armored spaces. They had watertight compartments. They had a lot of the new things that European navies had begun to adopt in the 1870s, and of course they had a much advanced steam propulsion system in spite of those masts and spars. So sometimes naval historians look at this moment in 1883 as the beginning, really the first blush of a revival that would reach its apogee in the next decade. But before I leave that, I want to put in a note of caution here, which is that as far as Congress was concerned, and really as far as the Navy was concerned, these new ships are really intended to perform the old functions. They're still for distant station patrol, coastline defense. So it's really something less than a full naval revolution and reconsidering what the Navy's going to do. We have these new ships, but not necessarily a new philosophy about what to do with them.
You touched on something that will be really neat when we get to the 1890s, which really was a great flowering for the navalist-minded. But in the 1880s, as we got the ABCD ships going, what was the general attitude behind building up the Navy? What was that driving force or desire? Was it simply the fact that everything was falling apart and we had to do something, or was there something else that was really driving that change in attitude?
Well, the easy answer is it's both of those things. I think for most people in America, it's really the first one. That is to say, our ships are old, we need to replace them, we can't be entirely helpless at sea. There were, of course, a number of far-sighted individuals, and I'm sure we're going to talk about a few of them in a minute or two here, who did see that the Navy needed to become something different. They were the ones who were instrumental in encouraging congressional authorization in 1886, 3 years after the ABCD ships, of the Navy's first battleships. Now, once again, that reference requires kind of a footnote or an aside, because they were officially listed as seagoing coastline battleships, whatever that may be. And I think the idea of putting the word coastline in there was to assuage the fears of those who thought, oh no, we're getting too big for our britches now, we're building battleships to go overseas and cause trouble. Making them coastline battleships meant they're really defensive weapons, and they looked it because they had a relatively low freeboard and operated best in coastal waters. But these were the Maine and the Texas, the first two battleships so designated by the United States Navy, and they were authorized in the 1880s, and I think most Americans saw them as simply ships that replaced the old and worn-out vessels left over from the war. But there were a few who saw this as the beginning of something not only bigger, but different.
And you bring on that attitude in the 1880s that the American public and its government had towards overseas entanglements, to use a good historical term. But what type of overseas activities was our Navy involved with during the 1880s?
Right. Well, not too many wars, obviously. Mostly the kinds of things that we associate today with perhaps humanitarian activities. Let me think. There was a polar expedition in the mid-decades, 1882, 83, 84, where they were going to try to explore the North Pole in the way that Charles Wilkes and the Exploring Expedition had explored the South Pole 3 decades earlier. And this group got going, International Polar Expedition. It was led by a Navy lieutenant, a guy named Adolphus Greely. And they set up a base camp well to the north, almost up, well up onto the polar ice above Greenland. And then it froze over and the supply ships couldn't get in. And this became kind of a popular issue that the newspapers picked up, and for a couple of years there was a big, you know, will they survive, can we get to them? And not until 1884 did the Navy manage to get a rescue operation up there. It was commanded, by the way, by Winfield Scott Schley, who would become famous in the Spanish-American War, which we'll talk about next time. But he led 4 ships up to the pole and found only 6 men still alive. That made a lot of press at the time. There was an expedition down to Panama where there had been an internal revolution, Panama regularly trying to break away from the Colombian government, and the United States, worrying about the security of the Trans-Isthmian Railroad, sent some warships down there, landed the Marines. This is what you did when American interests were threatened in third world sections of the planet. And so the Marines landed to keep order. The South Americans now worried, oh, the United States is getting ready to annex Panama, which we weren't. But Chile and Colombia both sent warships there. So there was a bit of a kerfuffle about whether the United States would fire shots in anger over Panama. And I guess probably the incident that very nearly led to war in the 1880s was one that happened right at the end of the decade in 1889 over Samoa, which both Germany and Britain and the United States had laid claim to. And three American ships, three German ships, and two British ships were all in Apia Harbor at the same time and watching each other very suspiciously, and tensions were ratcheting up. And then Mother Nature took care of the whole thing by sending a giant hurricane in there and smashed up everybody. And I think that probably is what led to the subsequent negotiations that divided authority among them. So in general, the United States was involved in expeditions overseas, some exploring, some humanitarian, in peacekeeping adventures in Panama and elsewhere, and to a certain extent as an instrument of diplomacy overseas, as we saw in Samoa.
We'll see in the next couple of decades, we talk about a couple of major wars that the results and the lessons learned really drove change, both from a strategic mindset and also from a shipbuilding and ship design concept. But when you look at the 1880s, most of the conflict around the war were land-focused wars of the colonial era. What were those things that was driving developments, either intellectually or technologically, during the 1880s, if there wasn't any active war going on to give the naval side of the house a chance to look at what's needed going forward?
Yeah, let me do technological first, because there were a lot of technological advances taking place, hand over fist, almost like our own modern day with electronics, only these, of course, had to do with propulsion and ordnance. Ordnance versus armor was an issue that was being played out in the 1880s. It carried over from the 1870s. In the American Civil War, of course, there had been armored ships, and that led a lot of navies to say, ah, this is the future, we'll pack iron armor on our ships and make them invulnerable. And the answer to that, of course, is having bigger guns that fired rifle shells with hardened points that could smash through that armor. So as each side sought to get thicker armor and bigger shells, it just got almost out of hand until both sides decided, well, you know what, you can't have enough armor to stop the biggest possible naval shell. So this was going on during the 1880s. And then in terms of propulsion, the question had already been resolved about the screw propeller being the dominant propulsion, but the efficiency of the steam engines that turned those screw propellers was developing. And it's really in late in the 1880s that the triple expansion engine comes into play that dramatically increases the efficiency of steam engines. You know, the United States Navy had stayed away from steam, had avoided it, in part because there were such long distances between our home country and those places where we wanted to represent our interests, such as the Asian coastline. So that steaming such a great distance in a very inefficient steam engine used up just monumental amounts of coal. But now with the triple expansion engine, it becomes possible to have dedicated steam-driven engines that can actually navigate 10, 15, 20,000 miles, although they did also have to refuel someplace, and that inhibited our decision-making as well. And you mentioned intellectually. I know you want to talk about Stephen Luce, and I don't want to step on your toes here, but I think he's the important figure that dominates American it's particularly progressive American thinking in the United States Navy about what the Navy should be, what it ought to be, and his role in founding the Naval War College in 1884 may be the single most important development of the decade in terms of pre-configuring what the Navy is going to look like in the subsequent decades.
You mentioned our friend there, Stephen B. Luce, and his position as he kind of puts a stake in the ground in the 1880s. Talk a bit how he is, in many ways, a fountainhead for a lot of the intellectual and professional development that we have in our Navy even today.
Well, he is. And I think the exhibit that's going on at the museum right now on warrior writers, he's really the archetype in a way, because he is a very prolific writer, not just in the 1880s, but beginning in the 70s, throughout the decade of the 80s, and really into the 90s. He writes articles about not only technology and tactics and strategy and administrative reform and the organization of naval bases and just about every aspect of naval training and planning and strategic consideration that there is. And he publishes these not just in the Proceedings, where they'll reach a professional audience, but in broader reach magazines like the North American Review, perhaps the most widely read periodical of the upper classes in the 1880s, and Critic magazine and elsewhere, so that they reached a public audience, not just a professional audience. And I think his role as the spokesman, as the thinker, as the philosopher of the Navy was crucial. And keep in mind, in this same decade, he not only founded the Naval War College in 1884, got its first year underway in 1885, he then turned over the presidency of the War College to Alfred Thayer Mahan, about whom we'll talk next time, I'm sure, and then became commander of the North Atlantic Squadron. So here's an actual warrior writer who was at the peak of his profession, both as a warrior and as a writer in the 1880s. So he's a key figure.
And on that note, I think we'll wrap up the 1880s. Thank you very much, Craig.
You're welcome.
Claude, over at the U.S. Naval Academy Museum during the 1880s, what are some of the highlights the visitor will find that are good representatives of the 1880s?
Well, we always have items on permanent exhibit on the first deck of the museum. I'll speak specifically to four items that we have for the Warrior Writer exhibit that is on display. It opened on the 10th of September, and it will be open until January 31st, 2016. The first item is actually a collection of items. Stephen B. Luce really dominated the pages of Proceedings in the 1880s. He is discussing naval history, grand tactics, and he does phrase it like that, grand tactics, not grand strategy, naval education. We have a large portrait of Luce that people will be familiar with him as an admiral. They're less familiar with the midshipman portrait that was done of Luce. He was a midshipman, Naval Academy class of 1848. And I think he's probably represented more than any other author in our Warrior Writers exhibit. There are the two portraits, but then there's a small ceramic figurine that was done of Luce as a midshipman after the portrait. It was done by Anne St. Clair Wright. She was the daughter of an admiral. In fact, he had been a warrior writer, had written for Proceedings. She becomes a historic preservationist of the 20th century, a very prominent one, and she had done this figurine as part of her series. And it's interesting from a local perspective, because she goes on to found historic Annapolis. So a lot of people who visit Annapolis will identify with that and the services they provide. The second item is a penny as well as a telegram from Charles Sigsbee. Charles Sigsbee authors articles in the 1880s as well as a commander. A decade and a half later, he is commander of the USS Maine when it blows up in Havana, Cuba. Now, one of the items is a penny, a coin that was taken, that was recovered from his office, his stateroom. But the second one is, I think, far more interesting from a historical perspective, and that's actually the very first draft, the very first telegram that he sent 15 minutes after the Maine is blown up and destroyed. In fact, he sends this telegram via a journalist who was in Cuba at the time, and he tells his counterpart at Forsyth in Key West, "Tell Admiral, Maine blown up and destroyed, send lighthouse tenders, many killed and wounded. Don't send war vessels if others available, Sigsbee." And in a subsequent one in articles, he does express a concern for public reaction to this event. So I think even in the immediacy of an attack like this, a major attack, which very few commanders have experienced in 250 years or so of our nation's history, including sometime with the British Empire, I think it's fascinating that he is calm, cool, under pressure, given that he's just lost his command, many of his men, and has the wherewithal to suggest that this could escalate very quickly. Consequently, let's try to temper it. So Sigsbee is very important to this exhibit. He's a class of 1864. He actually graduates from the Naval Academy in 63 because of the Civil War. The third item is a letter book from Norman Farquhar, later a Rear Admiral, Academy class of 1859. And this is one of those interesting letter books. You learn more about an individual. He had gone to sea seven times in his career. In fact, just a few years after he becomes commandant, he commands a squadron off of Samoa when it's experiencing storms that I believe that Craig Simons mentioned earlier. But in the letters, you see him resistant to his orders to Annapolis. He does not want to become the commandant. And there are a few letters that calmly suggest, no, this would be a very good idea for you to go to Annapolis, and here's why. And I think it was good overall because later he, as the first honorable prize mentioned in the general prize essay for proceedings, and he suggests that young officers should engage in intensive reading and study in such fields as the increase of fighting power, hydrographic information, history, languages, and physics. So he is somebody who assumes his role very well as commandant of the midshipmen, but again, he's a sailor first and foremost, and he recognized that. The fourth item is the ordnance notes of Lieutenant Edward Very, V-E-R-Y, class of 1867. He writes a series of articles in the 1880s on ordnance. Now, what's interesting about this particular piece is you see his thought process on how ordnance can be improved. He quantifies it. And he later patents a gun, the Very gun, and people are more familiar with it as the flare gun that we still use today. So I think in total, you start to see these individuals who take leadership roles later on, who are advancing intellectual pursuits and really advancing a Navy in a very challenging time. And I think that's not surprising. In the 1880s, for example, of about 225 articles, more than half of those were written by junior officers. In fact, there was one article that was written by Ensign Washington Irving Chambers, later an admiral and a father of naval aviation, where he submits a 57-page prize-winning essay. And I think that was extraordinary for an ensign to talk about restructuring and organizing the Navy in such a lengthy manner. And it didn't seem to hurt his career at all.
You know, what's interesting is I tell people all the time, if they find themselves in Annapolis, especially if they're people that really love museums, and if you have a nautical interest, you owe it to yourself, and don't branch out and say, okay, I'll give myself a 30-minute time wedge. Because I think what's really neat, what y'all have done at the U.S. Naval Academy Museum, is the way it's structured is an easy walk through, but you shouldn't walk too fast. You got to look to your left and your right, because you do have a lot of very, very interesting items with some good descriptions on them. And as a director of a museum, as with most museums, one thing you're looking for are new additions. And if you go back to the 1880s, which, you know, in a global context isn't too far away, but for an American context, that is pretty ancient history, where do we still find new items of interest in the late 1800s? Have most of the significant items already been cataloged and have found a home, or do we still find new items of interest that come on the marketplace or come to the attention of museums such that we have in Annapolis?
Well, you know, there's an old joke where I come from in Maine for many of the tourists. You know, if we run out of antiques, we'll find new ones for you very quickly. The fact is, we receive loans, donations all often. People will propose something to us. We determine if it fits in our collection. We have about 58,000 artifacts at the Naval Academy Museum, and only a portion of those can be shown at any one time. A lot of the items you'll see, the artifacts, are individuals. Honestly, people still find things in their attic. They say, well, my grandfather just passed away last week, and we were going through his things. We found this giant box of letters. And we found an extraordinary case a few years ago of a retired admiral who had a very lengthy career, and we were able to go through his letters and get a better understanding of the time in which he lived. We also do some acquisitions. It's very rare because artifacts tend to be very expensive. But we also do a lot of conservation work. We have older ship models on display. We have an entire boat model shop to not only build new ships, such as DDG 116, the Thomas Hudner, which is currently being constructed at Bath Ironworks. And we're building that on the at rest of the class of 1947, which was Thomas Hudner's class, Medal of Honor recipient. But we also conserve a lot of the original British dockyard models we have. We have the one of the largest collections of dockyard models in the world, second only to England, but we actually display more. They've been removing more and more from display. So we have an expert and a team of people who can essentially rebuild them.
And if people look at the 1880s and the developments that took place in a modern context, what would a lot of people, besides the ship dogs that everybody has, what would, I'll tell you what, I can edit this out.
Please edit that. Say it again. Sorry. There's a UPS guy outside. Hey, he's leaving. Sorry, man.
That's a good thing. We're not live. It's okay. I can clip it out.
Okay, the UPS guy is leaving, Callie. Come here.
Did a good job protecting Dad from the bad guy dressed in brown.
Yeah, okay.
Really adorable. Actually, sorry, maybe I will keep this. I don't know. No, I'll cut it out. It's all right. Okay, we'll do a 3, 2, 1.
Okay.
And then I'll make sure that I don't get too windy with my questions. 5, 4, 3. What would most visitors find surprising about some of the developments in the U.S. Navy in the 1880s as they go through the exhibit and look at that time period?
I think the design of the ships, the proposed integration of electricity. In fact, there was an article in Proceedings by an ensign in the 1880s who discussed the integration of electricity to the ships under construction. Craig mentioned the ABCD ships. I think they'd find of interest the designs, their tumble home bows, which to some degree, and it's not exact, but you still see remnants of that design with the new DD 1000 Zumwalt class. And I think that first of all is the design. The second is professional military education with regard to Luce's advocacy of war schools that would include a Naval War College established a decade, just a few years after he wrote about it, and which he founded. It was his first president. But also some of the Merchant Marine Academies. He was the one who had proposed Merchant Marine Academies, and it was the article was read by members of Congress and by state governments, and these were established not only nationally but in various states. So I think that's what people would find surprising is this transition. While ships continue to have masts because sail continued to be the most efficient form of sailing across the blue waters, and then they would simply turn on what sailors like folks in smaller communities would call the iron jennies, the iron Genoas. They would crank on their steam engines and maneuver in more shallow waters or in case of battle, they would be able to outmaneuver. So I think people would find it surprising. And people often have said that when we show them the designs of the USS Chicago, which was one of the ABCD ships, which we now have on display, they remark about the masts and the propellers that are associated with the ship.
Well, Claude, that wraps up the 1880s for us, and I invite our listeners to tune in to our next podcast where we'll dive in to one of the very busy times for the naval-minded, the 1890s.